en los que trabajarás tu listening y speaking en todo momento. 3 meses en los que subirás ese nivel tanto que, pues, que querrás otros 3 meses y otros 3. Entra en grupobauan.com e infórmate. Curso trimestral de Bauan. Si tienes alguna duda o necesitas información sobre cualquiera de nuestros cursos, llámanos al 91-133-5833. Repito, 91-133-5833.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on this program I'm going to talk about the early days of the colony of Virginia. This is the continuation of my program from last night. Last night I talked about the early days, I talked about how the colony would have failed if it hadn't been for Captain John Smith, who forced people to work. People did not want to work. John Smith said, it is a shame that the work of 40 or 50 people goes to feed the mouths of 150 to 200 idle, lazy, good-for-nothing. He used very bad language. Let's put it that way. But it's clear, you can see that there's only a minority of people in the colony that are good for anything, right? The others are just parasitical. Yeah, and finally, John Smith said, and this is very, very famous in the United States, we all quote John Smith. He said, he who will not work will not eat. And so, yeah, he got a monopoly of food and actually reduced many of the colonists to hunger, so that they were so desperate to eat they allowed themselves, you know, they were coerced. They were extorted into doing things, into physical work, hard physical work. The kind of work that kills people because they were dying like flies. And of course, after Smith left, the colony completely, it was reduced to a fragment of itself, right, from, 500 people to 50. But then came the big change, the turnaround. That was when John Rolfe made tobacco profitable. Well, actually, no, he didn't make it profitable. Well, he made it, first of all, he got the good tobacco. And the good tobacco was intellectual property. It was proprietary of plantations in Hispanic America. Nobody knows how he got it, presumably from contraband. But yes, there must have been some kind of surreptitious contact, maybe with Indians as intermediaries, who knows. But a surreptitious contact between these colonists and people in the Spanish Empire. And nobody knows where he got the idea from to use Spanish tobacco, because the local tobacco was no good. Well, it worked, and John Rolfe, if you smoke, you thank John Rolfe. He's the one who made it big. It was part of the Spanish Empire, but they never saw the commercial aspect to this, right? They never really exploited it in a big way. Whereas in Virginia, that's all they had. And yes, there was a very solid campaign of publicity, of advertising, of, at the beginning, smoking was good for you, right? It was supposed to be. Remember that the British character in the theory of the four humors, right? You have a sanguine character, and you have a melancholic character, and you have a choleric kind of personality. Depending on the fluids in the body, right? If you have blood, you're sanguine, right? If you have an excess of dark bile, no, bilis negro, you're melancholy. That's what the word means. If you have an excess of bilis, of green bile, or yel, which is, by the way, where we get the word yellow, if you've got that, then you're choleric. But if you have phlegm, then you are phlegmatic. And the British are always accused of having this phlegmatic character. And islands that are cold and wet are supposed to provoke phlegm and the phlegmatic character, right? Just as places that are hot and dry make people choleric. Hot and dry places are supposed to make people very angry all the time. And, you know, there's some logic to this. People could see how this might be true. In any case, the British consider themselves excessively phlegmatic. And one of the ways of reducing that was to breathe in hot, smoky tobacco, right? It was considered very, very good for your health and a corrective to the national character and the, let's call it the geographic destiny of the British Isles. It was the year 1611, right? Just after El Quijote was published. It was 1611. Quijote was published in, what, 1605? And this was just a couple of years later. You had the first tobacco crop. And 6 years later, before the second volume of El Quijote was published, 1617, you had 20,000 pounds of tobacco. And they had found a bottomless market. They'd found an insatiable appetite. Europeans, not just the English, but all over. And so the English began to export tobacco in a big way. Tobacco became increasingly important. And more and more colonists devoted themselves to this, and there was a great need for cheap labor, right? Mano de obra. You need people working those fields. You need plantations. Of course, tobacco was used as currency, as divisa, right? And curso legal, that you could interchange it. That's what people did. In 1622, you had 60,000 pounds of tobacco, and 1627, 500,000 pounds of tobacco. In other words, the growth was exponential. And a generation later, it was at 500,000 pounds. What am I saying? No. Back then it was at 500,000 pounds. A generation later, it was at 15 million pounds. I read that wrong. 15 million pounds within a generation. As I say, an insatiable demand. And nothing could have been better for the colony of Virginia, which, you know, if not for tobacco, if not for Spanish tobacco, if not for tobacco, if not for John Rolfe, it would have died. It would have become extinct. And the only North American, British presence in North America would have been these Puritans, who were exceptionally intolerant and and spent their day arguing with each other about how who could be the least tolerant, right? Now, I mentioned on an earlier program that the only way they were able to do this was the use of servants, people who came over under contract, poor people, under contract, usually 7 years because of the biblical precedent, right? In Genesis, you have Jacob with a 7-year contract. People came over, they worked, and after their contract was finished, they did have the chance to go out and find, well, to continue working, but receiving a salary, or to go out and start their own farm. But of course, very, very soon, that was going to place them directly in conflict with the Indians, because as the population increased, they would be pushing into the frontier. On my last program, I talked about the importance of that word in American English, frontier. We never use it as a synonym for border. The frontier for us is the unknown, beyond, right? The end of civilization. And of course, very soon it was going to be a tumultuous time in Northern Ireland. I talked about that on another program, but yes, Cromwell attacks Northern Ireland and founds with a large displacement of people, and founds a plantation economy in Ulster, sort of as a testing ground for what will later happen in the New World, right? Just as the Canary Islands was the mesa tabla de pruebas, no? For the New World. It was the testing ground. Ireland was the testing ground, England's testing ground for the New World, for what was going to happen later. This caused an enormous displacement of peoples, and so you did have large numbers of Irish arriving at this time. And these people died like flies. The numbers are shocking. From 1607 to the year 1622, you had 15,000 people coming in. Right? 15,000, an enormous number of people coming in. 15,000 to a colony which just a couple of years earlier, you know, had been down at 50 individuals. But here you have 15,000 people coming in, and only 2,000 of those people survived. And so this was good business. You bring in indentured servants, they will die on you, right? The other kind of labor, which arrived practically by accident, but yes, from very early on, were African slaves. Now, the slave trade was very, very busy at that time in the Caribbean. But, yeah, some African slaves did make it to Virginia, but they cost about twice as much as an indentured servant. And so, at least initially, were not very profitable. Little by little, of course, the African slave who was never liberated, the African slave would replace this system of indentured servants. But of the 50,000 people arriving between 1650 between 1650 and 1675, right, in the third quarter of the 17th century, you had about 50,000 people arriving, and only 3,000 of those people were slaves were African slaves. So yes, at least initially, that was not the system being used. But little by little, in the southern area, you did have a system, a way of life developing that was closer to what you found in the in Brazil or many parts of the Caribbean. You had like latifundia. You had these enormous estates. There were counties in Virginia at this time where only about 5% of the population owned most of the land. On an earlier program, I was talking about Bacon's Rebellion, where the poor people, the disenfranchised, the ones who, the haves and the have-nots, right? We're talking about the have-nots, freed indentured servants who had no choice. Really, if they wanted new land, they were going to have to go out into Indian territory and get that land. And when the Indians punished them for stealing the land, then the whole ideology changed. And these people compared themselves, for example, to the Israelites in the Promised Land, right? After... walking in and killing the native population, essentially, right? The Canaanites. And all of this biblical history from the book of Judges, with references to Moab and references to the Philistines and references to Joshua at Jericho. Right. All of these, they compared themselves to people who had a right to this land. Right. By the way, that part of the Bible is one of the things that archaeology tells us is complete fiction. Right. It didn't happen like that. Those battles. That are listed in the Bible and treated as great triumphs. Many of those cities exist. We know where they are, but archaeology tells us there was no battle at that time. Right? It's far, far more likely that, the people in the Bible, right? The Israelites in the Bible grew out of that same area. I mean, they were indistinguishable, at least initially, from their neighbors, the Canaanites, who are none other than the Phoenicians, right? These are the same people as in Tyre and Byblos and the other great Phoenician cities. This is the southern version, the Canaanites, and the Israelites are, you know, genetically and in terms of material culture, indistinguishable, at least initially. Yes, sometimes archaeology coincides with the Bible, but more often it doesn't. And you just have to understand that. In any case, these people knew nothing about biblical archaeology, but they did believe that they were emulating the people who had been given the promised land, and that they were justified in anything they did to the native population. And so, in Bacon's Rebellion, which I talked about extensively on another program, you did have these people who believed that they were justified in exterminating the natives. And when the colonial authorities disagreed, these people rebelled and expelled the colonial authorities. It was the La Chusma, was the rabble, rebelling against the aristocrats. And all the geopolitics by the royal governors of trying to cultivate relations with neutral or friendly Indians and use them as allies against hostile Indians were being undone by people like Nathaniel Bacon, who believed in genocide, and the only good Indian is a dead Indian, and there are no friendly or neutral Indians, only hostile Indians. And yes, people often contrast this with the treatment that the natives were given in the Spanish Empire, where everybody, right from the time of Fernando y Isabel, whom we call Ferdinand and Isabella. These are the Catholic monarchs, right, in English? Ferdinand and Isabella. And these two took their sacred duties very, very seriously. They were part of the reason that the Pope allowed them to control the Americas was because they were supposed to play a role in the conversion of the Indians. And from the very beginning, the Indians were treated as if they had souls, as if they were thinking human beings, reasoning human beings. And things like extermination were abhorrent, were considered horrific back in Madrid. On a local level, not so much. And part of it is demographics. I'll look at it this way. In reality, there weren't, after a while, in the English colonies, there weren't that many Indians out there. And extermination was possible. Whereas in the Spanish Empire, you had an enormous density of population. And where there was a dense population, there was fighting, there was domination, but there was no attempt at extermination. Think of Mexico, New Spain, right? Nueva España. Or think of, this is the viceroyaldom of New Spain, or Peru. Right? There, the population density made this kind of hostility I'm talking about made it completely impractical. However, even in the Spanish Empire, and even with the idea of saving the souls of the Indians, where there wasn't a lot of demographic pressure, where Indians were scarce, things were different. Think of a place like Chile or Cuba, where today you don't have a big indigenous presence, right? The indigenous peoples were eliminated a lot like they were in the English colonies in North America with similar demographics. Not so much ideology here, as demographics, something that would have been unthinkable in Peru or Mexico because of the sheer number of natives. And so now let me turn to the area south, the area between the Spanish Empire, you know, down in Florida, on an earlier program, I was talking about the attempts to do something in Florida at the very periphery of the empire, right? Too little, too late, underfunded, right? Never enough money. Pathetic attempts by the Spaniards to put missions and colonies in Florida, when everybody knew that the money was elsewhere and the future was somewhere else. Right? I talked about the fact that, you know, when the Spaniards wanted to send people to San Augustine, in Florida, the oldest the oldest population, the oldest at least European population center in what is today the United States. San Agustin, Florida, right? More than 500 years. Well, when the Spaniards did want to send people there, it was in chains because nobody wanted to go there. Nobody who could be anywhere else would voluntarily go to Florida. And yes, this was a complete debacle. In any case, the Franciscans, the Jesuits were there. Little by little, in spite of what I just said before about the extermination of the natives, little by little, the natives in Florida began to like the Spaniards. And later on, it was going to surprise everybody that if you wanted to communicate with the natives in Florida, you would have to do it in Spanish. They seem to have preferred the Spaniards and the Spanish way, at least some European thing that they understood, certainly to the English, because of the vicissitudes of the Bourbons and the Pact of the Families and so forth in the 17th century. This area is going to revert to England later, after it had already been Spanish for a while. But Florida at this point was kind of the border. And then you had what is going to be the Carolinas and Georgia, and a mixed attempt at founding Spanish colonies further north or English colonies further south. I'm going to have to talk about that on the second part of the program.
Profesionales de su empresa no comunican eficazmente en inglés, su empresa no necesita clases de inglés. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente. Muchas son las empresas españolas que despilfarran el dinero contratando clases de inglés a diestro y siniestro. Café para todos y resultados para nadie. Dominar el inglés requiere enfoque, esfuerzo y un plan. En Baugen Empresas tenemos un plan hecho a medida para su empresa. No nos interesa vender clases, nos interesa conseguir soluciones. Y para ello, tenemos un apasionado equipo de profesores formados meticulosamente en el método Baugen. Llama al 911-335831, 911-335831. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente.
Sin prisa pero sin pausa. This is the Spanish expression that I use when people ask me what they should do with their children concerning English. Sin prisa pero sin pausa. The target date for English mastery is age 23. Children and adolescents don't need English, really, until they reach adulthood, until they finish their studies and start looking for their first job. This is usually at the age of 23. If they don't know English well at this point, they are in trouble. They have a problem, an important problem. If they don't know English well at the age of 23, when they enter the labor market, they will probably never reach a decent level, a good working level of English. So, as a mother or father, you need to make sure that your children gain a good command of English by the age of 23 at the latest. This means that when the child is born, you have 23 years to solve the problem. Are you capable of solving a problem if you have a 23-year window to solve it? I hope so. Here in Vaughn Systems, we provide kids, children, with dynamic verbal access to English starting at the age of 4. We expose the children to the native sound of the language, and we work especially hard to promote effective listening comprehension and to make the language fun and attractive for the children. Entrust your children to us, little by little, slowly but surely, sin prisa pero sin pausa. We will transform them into bilingual adolescents and prepare them for age 23. Contact Vaughan Jr.
Más información sobre la línea Junior de Vaughan Systems en el teléfono 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832.
Atención, tenemos muy buenas noticias para ti. Ahora nuestro EMIP, el Executive Master en Inglés Profesional, también lo podrá realizar a mediodía, de lunes a viernes de 2 a 4 de la tarde. Aprovechate, llama al 91-133-5833. 91-133-5833. Nuestro EMIP, ahora también a mediodía. Si tienes alguna duda o necesitas información sobre cualquiera de nuestros cursos, llámanos al 91-133-5833. Repito, 91-133-5833.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on the first part of the program, I was speaking about Virginia, the colony of Virginia, and how to make it economically viable. Once it was economically viable, the plantation economy, initially with servants, indentured servants, and then later with slaves. That was the way to go. And tobacco was the way to go. And in international geopolitics, well, there were a lot of things happening. The transition in Spain to the Bourbon dynasty and the Bourbon way of doing things, and all of these reforms in the beginning of the 18th century. Of course, when the French finally did take over in Spain, it wasn't for very long, right? The Isabel de Farnese, the whole thing, Spain's main concern became Italy. Many of the reformers were Italian. And all the time and energy was spent thinking about Italy and less the Americas. And so it was a very, very long time before real reforms, before real things began to coalesce in terms of making the Americas Spanish, making them profitable, coordinating them, and rationalizing the whole situation, which of course is going to lead to exploitation and resentment and eventually independence of those colonies. But that of course is toward the end of the century. At the beginning of the century, what you have is a series of treaties which, well, it's a game changer for Spain. So that if in the 17th century, Spain's main enemy was France and everything was conducted on land, meaning that the army, the infantry, the cavalry, all of that, the tercios, that all of that was essential to Spain. Then all of a sudden, the 18th century, the big game changer, all of a sudden the 18th century reveals that Spain, that everything is about the sea. Right? It goes from land to sea. However, as I say, in the Spanish court, you still have people thinking about land. You still have people thinking about Italy and other Spanish possessions. You know, they had lost land in in the Netherlands. They had lost land, well, all over. The European part ended with the Habsburgs. They had also lost Menorca, the island of Menorca, and Gibraltar, and wanted both of those back. So, yeah, a lot of people were thinking about land. And here we go with the sea and international geopolitics in terms of how much of the sea you can control from various positions around the world. And England was ahead of them in this. Now, England had... in the Treaty of Utrecht, part of that was Spain had lost its trade monopoly. The English supposedly could send one ship per year to trade, but of course they immediately exploited this, and so many, many, many ships and all kinds of pirates and smugglers, right, contrabandistas, smugglers, just everywhere, just kind of uncontrolled. Right? When Spain lost its trade monopoly, that was, the 18th century began in a, kind of a bad way. And then, El Asiento de Negros as well, so that other people could trade in slaves from Africa. Now, the British... under the Restoration, under the Stuart Restoration, right, 1660, and you know, after the Interregnum, after the Commonwealth, after Cromwell fell, when they came back, with new techniques. Financial techniques that were just getting underway then, 17th century, things like the companies, right? Modern capitalism. Now, when you talk about modern capitalism, you also talk about finance, and there were all kinds of financial innovations. Now, at the time, the real financial innovations were going on in Amsterdam, right? Because those people, when they discovered that they were independent... also realized that, you know, half the country had been claimed from the water, right, with dikes. They really had no natural resources. The only thing they could do was farm more and more intensively, and that was the road to nowhere. So there was no other solution but think outside the box, right? And that is when the Dutch began to expand in a big way internationally and go into trade in a big way internationally. And when they began to innovate in terms of finance, in terms of international exploration and a financial backing for that exploration and companies, and insurance, shared risk, and debt. All of these things, they were going on in Amsterdam. And then all of a sudden in 1688, you have a Dutch king on the English throne. And lots of people are going to come from Amsterdam with these new ideas and new techniques. And London, of course, will discover the new world of financial capitalism. This is going to be a game changer. Now, evidently, you know, at the very beginning of this financial boom, people fell into traps. We know them today as traps. Financing things where finance and realism get divorced. when reality and common sense no longer inform financial decisions. You invest because you know that other people are going to invest and things go, this up and down cycle, this irrational exuberance followed by panic, which has absolutely nothing to do with the real value of things or common sense. All of this was created at the very, very beginning of these financial techniques, at the very beginning of capitalism. So yes, in Amsterdam, you had tulip mania, right? People began to invest in tulips. And supposedly, you know, I've read histories that say this isn't true. I've read histories that say this is an exaggeration, and this is kind of a, it's a good story, but it wasn't like that, or at least, but then I read other stories who say, yeah, that historians saying that this is just exactly what happened. So I'm not sure, but I'll tell you in any case that, you know, at one point, people were investing in, tulips that, tulip bulbs that hadn't seen, right? Tulip futures, let's call it that. Tulip futures, not because of the intrinsic value, but for pure speculation. Remember that the word speculation, specula, that means a mirror in Latin. So yeah, people looking in mirrors, in halls of mirrors, mirrors reflecting mirrors. And that is what speculation actually means. Now, if you think about that, that was the crash was inevitable, and the crash hurt. But people didn't understand the mechanism at the time. And this same mechanism, as I say, moved over to London in 1688. Now, just a few years later, you have the Treaty of Utrecht and the British all of a sudden think that Spanish America is vulnerable and that Potosí there will be in British hands, and this is imminent. And they're just frotándose las manos, right? They're rubbing their fingers together. They've got Gibraltar, they've got Menorca, and they're going to get the rest. And so they begin to speculate as to the future of British Spanish America. And, you know, there's a company, and it's called the South Sea Company. Remember that when Núñez Balboa first saw the new ocean, he was looking south. The Isthmus of Panama makes a little S, and so he was looking south, and he called it El Mar del Sur. Right? And in Spanish, it was known as El Mar del Sur for a long time. Later on, it was called the Pacifico. But yes, the South Sea. It was also known as the South Sea in English. And they thought that the Pacific, which at that time was kind of a Spanish lake, even though Francis Drake had been there, the Pacific was still, you know, the Carta de Indias and the Galeones and so forth. That was all Spanish. That they thought that the that it was imminent that that they were going to get their hands on that, and there was going to be an enormous amount of profit. And as I say, these financial regulations and common sense about finance didn't exist back then. And so you had the South Sea bubble. When you talk about seas, it's you talk about bubbles, right? And so is a burbuja de inversión, no? Burbuja. The whole idea of bubble, it's a wonderful metaphor, but it comes precisely from then and there, from the South Sea. The South Sea bubble. And the bubble exploded. And the government had to intervene, and it was a mess, and financially, London was in a hole for decades after that. And people were furious, and there were, well, yeah, other things. Scotland attempted to put colonists in what is today Panama, and that was a complete failure, and that drove many people. The ire, let's call it ira, right? La ira, the ire of the British Isles was now concentrated on Spanish America, and so any pretext for a war would be good enough. You have, for example, the War of Jenkins' Ear at this time. Jenkins was an idiot, and he was busy in contraband, in smuggling, right? A local Spanish authority caught him, and at least according to Jenkins, ordered that his ear be cut off as punishment. And Jenkins kept that ear and told his story to anybody in London who would listen to it. And then all of a sudden it became inflated by news. And, you know, everybody was talking about Jenkins and Jenkins' ear and how this outrage, right, ultraje, how this outrage was intolerable. And so, yeah, there was a series of wars and bad blood between England and Spain in Spanish America at this time. And so one of the battlegrounds that we're going to talk about is precisely that area between Virginia and Florida. Between Jamestown and of course later Williamsburg and San Agustin. On an earlier program, I talked about the initiative on the part of people in Barbados, that very successful English colony in the Lesser Antilles, right? In the that sort of crescent of islands between the Atlantic and the Caribbean and Gulf of Mexico, right? The Lesser Antilles. You've got Barbados, and Barbados from pretty early on, it became an enormously lucrative sugar-growing colony with plantations and huge numbers of slaves, African slaves, working those plantations. The people in Barbados, well, Barbados, it became a monoculture, right? A single-crop island. All of the local flora and fauna were sacrificed, so it was pretty much exclusively cane field. And there was no more land. These people needed more, they wanted more, and they established themselves in Carolina. So yes, Carolina was an initiative from the New World, not from the Old World, from the New World. Carolina was Barbados II. They used the laws of Barbados. The people were Barbadian. They were, it was not English. It was not English. It was Caribbean by nature. I mean, you go there today, and yes, you can see it's different. If you go to Charleston, South Carolina, it's different. But what about further south? What about the hot spot? right? If anything happens, it's going to be in what is today Georgia. And that is where James Oglethorpe comes in. James Oglethorpe, General James Oglethorpe. Now, at this time, you had all kinds of thoughts coming in from the Ilustración, the Enlightenment. And you had enlightened thinkers, of course, in the time of Fernando VI. Well, actually, even back with Felipe V, you had like proto-enlightened people in Fernando VI, his son, and Carlos III, his other son. You got people who were deeply influenced by French ideas. Then you had somebody like Florida Blanca, who was influenced by Adam Smith and the prevalent English Enlightenment, but especially under Carlos III, many of these people were Italian, right? Grimaldi, Scarlatti. But the idea is that Enlightenment ideas were pervading everywhere. And one of these was a way to handle people in debt, right? People who had found themselves in debt, unlike governments, the rise and fall of speculation in the stock market, that debt was considered a moral failing. And people, of course, personally responsible for their debts. Also, the idea of indigent people, beggars. Well, what to do about them? Back in traditional times, people just looked at the Bible and Jesus said, "The poor will be with you always." And that was good enough for most people. Yeah, okay, the poor are with us, just as Jesus said in the Bible. But it was not a question of what to do. Traditionally, for example, in Madrid, beggars had licenses. And they could show you their license. In other places, licensed beggars could make a living also as familiars for the Inquisition. It depended on, you know, how active they were, how much they knew, how useful they were for the Inquisition. But yes, they could be familiars. And of course, you can imagine the fights between licensed beggars and unlicensed beggars. In any case, that began to change. And one of the ideas was to lock them up, to incarcerate them, and to put them in workhouses and allow them to work off their debt. In this case, you know, if they had anybody on the outside who could feed them, that would be much better. Otherwise, they're working off their debt and they have a calorie deficit and things look very, very bad for them. Workhouses, by the way, traditionally in England at least, they were present right through the 19th century. If you read the novels of Charles Dickens, you know, something like Oliver Twist, you've got workhouses. In Madrid, then the northern part of Madrid, next to the Glorieta de Bilbao, right, where people would leave the city to go to Bilbao, that area, which was traditionally where the Pozos de Nieve were located, where people could get, in summertime, people could get snow that had fallen in winter, from that area. Well, they built this enormous building, which today, of course, is the Municipal Museum. And that, in its day, had more than 2,000 people working, forcibly working. You know, it was similar to a poorhouse. Oglethorpe hated this idea, and Oglethorpe wanted to take these people across the Atlantic and put them in a colony which was there, its existence was there to be a kind of a buffer, to be a kind of a protection, a cushion, cojín, right? A cushion between St. Augustine and Charleston, right? Between the Spanish Empire and British North America. They would be there in the line of fire, but anything would be better than a workhouse, or at least so he thought. All right, I'm going to have to continue this, though, on my next program.